one of the main findings in my book is that HIV/AIDS, while it kills many people in Malawi, and while it has had serious repercussions economically and socially, it is not the most important thing among Malawians in terms of what should be prioritized.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
As the international community addresses numerous development challenges, we must often pause, reflect, and ask, do good intentions lead to good results? If so, when? And how? There are indeed innumerable development agendas and a multitude of stakeholders involved in saving lives as well as promoting long-term development in many parts of the developing world. What really is the impact of these activities? And are such activities well coordinated? How effectively can external actors make a meaningful contribution to alleviating local problems? And most importantly, whose priorities do such interventions address? And to what extent are the so-called beneficiaries consulted? I discuss these issues and more with my guest today, Kim Yi Dion, a professor of political science at the University of California, Riverside. Her research focuses on African politics, public opinion, and political behavior. Kim also edits The Monkey Cage, a blog on politics and political science at The Washington Post. And as it turns out, Kim and I have something in common. We both love the beautiful country of Malawi, where Kim has conducted much of her recent research. The focus of our conversation was on Kim's fascinating book called Doomed Interventions, The Failure of Global Responses to AIDS in Africa, which was published in 2018 by Cambridge University Press. I began by asking her a very broad question. What characterizes global interventions to improve the human condition on the African continent?
That's a great question. Thank you so much, Dan, for having me on the podcast. I'm a big fan of your work and of this new show. So your question, I think if we put it in a broader historical perspective, I think that, you know, we could probably have a more positive view of global interventions. I think that generally, when we think of global interventions, it's hard to disentangle them from interventions that are imagined and designed in corridors of power in global capitals like Washington, D.C. And London, right? So you have these ideas of how to improve the condition in places where more people are poor. And then these imagined interventions then trickle through this global to local supply chain, and they don't always turn out to be the same as they were imagined, right? In these global capitals, in these metropoles, and they get, you know, redesigned and reimagined, and then what we see often is that because they don't really resemble how they were initially designed, they don't function in the way that they were imagined. Now, of course, I don't want to put all of the weight on implementation. I think that sometimes the design of these global interventions to improve the human condition are often made by people who are very far from the problems or issues at hand. And so You can have an idea for wanting to, for example, alleviate food insecurity in some place, you know, thousands of miles from you in a different country with a population of people you may have never met. And it's hard for you as this person who's designing this intervention from afar, it's hard for you to imagine all the things that are required for that intervention to succeed. And so it's often that we see these kinds of interventions fail. And it's too bad. I do think that a lot of people who are designing interventions from afar really do mean well. I don't think that they have malintentions. But often, because of this great distance, not just geographically, but distance in imaginations, I think we see a lot of these interventions fail.
I really, really enjoyed reading your book. It was such a pleasure. The way in which you make your argument, it's not only persuasive, but I also like the style. It is easy to read. And so I was absolutely engrossed. And what I particularly liked about the argument is that, and I've been trying to make a similar argument, that there's an international policy overload when it comes to development. I like the fact that you make a persuasive case for there being just too many cooks spoiling the broth. And what is surprising from what you just said is that it seems that we're not really learning anything, because for several decades, there's been this kind of focus on localization, the importance of local knowledge, harmonization of policy, consulting, and making development more participatory. And yet in your book, you actually show very, very clearly why this kind of massive global intervention on HIV/AIDS or anything really doesn't work, because there's just so many actors involved. And what I thought was just really, really the most important part, and it was shocking that the so-called intended beneficiaries are not really consulted. So could you take us through this process, particularly in relation to the argument that you make in the book?
Sure. So I think that the shift in at least the way we talk about or think about development interventions, I think the shift is there, right? As you've said, for many years, we've been talking about participatory approaches to development. We've been talking about local consultation. And that the fact that that's in the conversation makes me hopeful. At least there is something shameful about presuming to know better than intended beneficiaries, right? Now, of course, the challenge still remains to actually have meaningful engagement among intended beneficiaries, to actually asking them what they think is important, what should be prioritized, and more importantly, how things should be done, because they're going to know their context better and they're going to understand the social, political, economic constraints surrounding any sort of intervention. So I guess, you know, I don't want to put myself outside of this box of people who continue to make this mistake. I mean, I'm sure as you have experienced as well, you know, we don't live in these developing countries, and that we work in and do research in, and it requires us to be mindful when we collect data, when we try to analyze data that's been collected in these settings, and then try to make sense of it, right? What are the ways we can do that values the ideas and knowledge in these places, right? So for me, that's meant, you know, active partnerships with researchers based in the context where I work, right? Just like you, right? When I work in Malawi, I often am working with a Malawian scholar who's going to know the context better. And I think that there are lessons that some of us in the academy who are doing thoughtful collaborations, I think that there are lessons for people in the development world as well to, you know, have true partnerships, not, you know, hire a consultant that can tell you all about, you know, the things happening in Zambia, you know, but actually finding your co-partner, someone who it, you know, has about the same amount of experience as you, but is going to understand and know the local context better, and that they have equal say in the decisions that are going to be made about an intervention or about a set of initiatives under some policy initiative. I think, you know, that kind of collaboration, I mean, you know as well as I do, when I collaborate like that in my research, particularly my research on Malawi, the research is so much richer and I feel so much more confident in the results that I can't imagine the same wouldn't also be true for our colleagues who are practitioners in development.
So the question then here is, Kim, why is it that there's still this huge reluctance, especially in, say, Washington or in Rome or Paris or New York or all these Western capitals, one would say perhaps also in relation to UN agencies, to better understand the local context? What is preventing these actors from perhaps actively seeking that kind of local knowledge? And we'll talk about Malawi slightly later on in the conversation. I read in a part of your book that towards the end, when you were presenting your work to a group of practitioners in Malawi's capital, Lilongwe, they actually appeared to be willing to change their practices based on what they found was extremely surprising from your own work. But you said something, or you wrote something about the fact that they were constrained. So even, say, practitioners at the regional, local level may want to change, may want to adopt, you know, new practices based on local knowledge, and yet there are these other constraints from international headquarters. So how do you explain this reluctance to embrace local knowledge?
It's a great question. And I think the example that you bring up is a perfect illustration of this. So when I was doing my research for the book, I was, you know, in Malawi for 7 months with my family. And as I was leaving, the U.S. Embassy invited me to come and give a talk about whatever my preliminary findings were, because I was in Malawi as a Fulbright Fellow. And this was, you know, this was kind of standard fare for Fulbright Fellows to stop at the embassy on your way out and just share with folks in interested people to learn more about whatever it was you were doing. And there were people from NGOs, from government ministries, and also from various donor agencies. And one of the main findings in my book is that HIV/AIDS, while it kills many people in Malawi, and while it has had serious repercussions economically and socially, it is not the most important thing among Malawians in terms of what should be prioritized, right? And in fact, in the survey and qualitative data that I collected for the book, the most important thing is access to clean water. Second most important thing is agricultural development, because as you know, food insecurity has been a major issue in Malawi for decades, ever since, you know, climate change changed weather and particularly rainfall patterns, and that has made farming in Malawi difficult. And Malawi relies a great deal on subsistence farming. So what the development practitioners were wondering is like, well, how do we make these interventions that you say Malawians prioritize higher when we have all of this funding from our bosses in these global capitals that is tied specifically to HIV/AIDS? You know, so the constraints that they were dealing with was that they were now informed with what is actually a priority, but they're constrained by their budgets, right? So this is an old school political science bureaucracy problem, right? That bureaucrats are forever constrained by their budgets. And so I think the question of, you know, why, even when people are informed with new information, why don't they change? It's because the existing systems require them to do something else. And so until someone introduces broader systemic change, then we're not going to see a shift in the way development is done. Now, what would that change look like? You know, in this example that we're talking about, it would mean a drastic shift either in the priorities of donors to more closely align the priorities of their intended beneficiaries of these interventions to improve the human condition, or it would require them to allow their bureaucrats greater flexibility in changing the nature or sector in which their work is going to be done. And I think that, you know, it's going to be hard to do either of those things, right? So with the latter, right, with allowing bureaucrats more flexibility, I mean, the reason why bureaucrats are not given flexibility to make these changes, right, why these development practitioners who certainly know better than their bosses in DC, you know, they're not allowed to make those changes because, you know, those constraints are there to protect against, for example, issues of corruption or governance, right? That there's not favoritism, right? And that there's a process for determining budgets and priorities and allocations, right? Now, for the former, right, to have real, meaningful, thoughtful solicitation and elicitation of priorities from intended beneficiaries, I think that there are some examples of this, right, where there were these listening campaigns to try to hear what people wanted. But it has never been at a broad scale, right? You're not seeing that. And part of that is, I think people are relying on their counterparts, right? So if you're in DC and you work for USAID or you work for the State Department, you're going to rely on your counterparts in the ministries of, you know, the governments where you're working, right? So in Malawi, that would be, you know, maybe the ministers or their assistants or deputies in the Ministry of Local Government, right? Or you're going to be relying on, you know, the people in the diplomatic corps of Malawi to tell you what those are. And those higher level bureaucrats on, you know, in developing countries, to what extent are they representing the interests of the poor in their countries? And in the case of Malawi, right, a case that both of us know very well, a lot of those ministerial appointments, we know, have been driven not as much by qualifications or expertise so much as they've been driven by politics, right? So politics or favoritism, you know, who has a relationship or can offer something of value to presidents in power. And who knows, that may be changing in Malawi. I don't know the extent to which that is better in other poor countries that have experience, you know, have a long experience of having ministries at the higher levels really staffed by appointed officials who are very divorced from the experience of everyday people.
I feel that part of the problem, Kim, is that, you know, and you're absolutely right to say that some of these people in the ministries are just in it to secure as much external funding as possible. So they may not be very knowledgeable, but there is also this aspect of how the international system creates and establishes and promotes a certain type of jargon, whether it be the MDGs or now the Sustainable Development Goals, SDG, which requires which requires some sort of a proofing, you know? So everything has to be SDG or poverty or HIV proofed in order to gain the attention of the donors. So I notice in many capitals, not just in African countries, but also in Asia, there's certain bureaucrats who just are experts at talking a certain lingo that the donors like. And if you don't speak that lingo, then you're not going to get funding. They may disagree with this, but it is all about getting access to the funds. And the second set of issues, and I'd like to hear your views on it, I love the title of your book, Doomed Interventions. And I sometimes wonder whether some of the problem related to us not perhaps appreciating local knowledge enough is by that term itself, intervention. It creates this kind of distance, you know? It perpetuates an idea, perhaps, that somebody needs to be saved and, you know, we have the solutions and we're going to intervene, rather than using other more perhaps preferable terms that indicate the preference for participation. What do you think of these?
I'm glad you like the title of the book. I really hate it. So because I really don't think everything is doomed, and I agree with you. I don't know that, you know, intervention itself does have these. It's wrapped up in this idea that, you know, someone's coming in from the outside, right? And it doesn't have to be that way. We can imagine other, right? I love using the word initiative, right? Because it also has this like positive action, like people are taking the initiative, you know? I feel like I'm probably the only person who cares this much about the kinds of language we use, but I do think it affects how people think about places. And I don't want people to think that, you know, the things we need to do to make the world less unequal and to give people greater opportunity than they have just by virtue of the lottery of where they were born, I think that is not a doomed endeavor. I just think that the way we've currently imagined how this is supposed to be done, that lends itself to more failure than success. And can we think of ways, you know, that this would be done differently? And I think I don't really prize that, you know, there has to be global interventions. I don't really think that, you know, there needs to be rich countries playing a role in how to increase development in poor countries. I think that, you know, rich countries played a pretty important historical role in making some of these countries poor. So I think it's right for anyone, you know, living in these countries to question the motives and even the abilities of people in rich countries making suggestions that they know better. And I include myself in, you know, I was born and raised here in the United States of America, and my country has a long imperial history. And so who am I to say how Malawi's development should happen? And I found, you know, much like you're saying with this kind of global buzzword speak about SDGs and previously MDGs and all of the jargon that comes with that, I saw that as well with HIV/AIDS. You know, any new person I met, whether in Tanzania or Malawi or elsewhere, when they heard that I was doing research on HIV/AIDS, they could tell me all the buzzwords about, you know, gender mainstreaming and, you know, all of these things. And that wasn't, you know, I wasn't, it's so performative. And to me, at first I would find it really annoying, you know, and I was like, oh, they think I'm one of those Americans, you know, who prizes these things. But then, you know, I got over myself and I thought about it and I said, you know, this is really useful data, because when people, you know, when strangers first meet me and this is what they say, it's suggesting to all of us that, you know, they're perfectly you know, Malawians, Tanzanians are perfectly capable of understanding how the game is played, and they know how to play the game too. And they see where resources are and how those resources, you know, how to get them. And for the average, you know, if they had encountered someone from USAID or from Save the Children, you know, that might have landed them a job. That might have gotten them a connection to the community-based organization that they had founded and gotten resources to them. So they're quite entrepreneurial. And I think that that kind of entrepreneurship is valued by the existing system. You know, but it doesn't push the needle further in improving anything. All it does is further entrench, right, these kind of, I don't want to call them clientelistic relationships, but these ideas that somehow the resources coming from afar are more valuable than the knowledge and ideas produced locally.
So the international development agenda, broadly speaking, of course, there are so many issues, Kim, that require world attention, and often a part of the advocacy campaigns, I suppose, is to highlight that this particular issue requires more attention. I see, you know, civil society organizations always, you know, promoting the argument that the kind of work that they're doing is the most important work and that should require greater funds. But when certain matters, certain topics, certain problems do receive attention, like HIV/AIDS, and also in my case, I've been working on famines, these are sensational events, it appears to me, and I see that also in your book, that you make the argument that it's wonderful to have all this attention, the generosity, the funds pouring in, but it creates many distortions. In my own work on famines, I find that, you know, one doesn't really react early enough. There are all kinds of early warning signs of food insecurity, you know, migration, people selling their children, it's only when people die in front of you on the streets of the capital that you really realize something is wrong. And it has to be an international report on the BBC or CNN to really spark this kind of attention. And in your own work and in the book, I feel that the famine and HIV/AIDS agendas look very similar, because you, and I want to quote you, you write, HIV exceptionalism produces more HIV exceptionalism. And you argue that AIDS just does not eclipse other diseases in relation to funding, but funding for AIDS has also overshadowed support for health generally. And I think there is a tension here, isn't there, between putting something on the agenda, getting attention, and then risking that this one issue overshadows everything else that may be of greater concern to the local population. But we decide that something warrants more attention than something else.
Yes, and I want to credit appropriately, my ideas on HIV exceptionalism are largely informed by the excellent work and award-winning book by Adia Benton titled HIV Exceptionalism. And what I've learned from her work and from working with her is about not just these distortions, but also some of the opportunities as well. So I think that my work is a little limited in this respect, and I think it's where I would push my own work a bit further to imagine is that the way I've written about HIV exceptionalism is perhaps a bit more pessimistic than it needs to be. So I do think that HIV has taken up a lot of space in development in the last 30 years. And maybe that's less so today than perhaps 10 years ago when I was finishing the research for this book. But, you know, it's a known fact, right? You just look at the levels of funding to HIV versus any other development issue or any other health issue, even though HIV was not the leading cause of morbidity or mortality. And it was a leading cause, but not the leading cause. And so, you know, I was like, you know, that's not right. You know, more should be spent on diarrheal disease. You know, people should, you know, have access to clean water to wash their hands. You know, that's, if you look at the numbers, you know, but it's a really simple way of looking at it. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think if I could have been a bit more, if I could have thought of it a little bit more deeply, right? So if we think, for example, of the work of Partners in Health, right? You know, they did a lot of the advocacy work for extending access to care for things like HIV, AIDS, and tuberculosis. And when they did that, they created healthcare systems, you know, well, should I say systems? They created healthcare networks that offered more than just HIV, AIDS, TB care. So I think that there are some creative people out there who are using even this exceptionalist agenda to further another agenda of just increasing access to healthcare. And I think that HIV exceptionalism has created some opportunity for that, though I do think that PIH is exceptional. There, you know, not everyone is doing that. I think people are sticking very clearly in their vertical silo of only HIV AIDS. And I write about that a lot in the book, that, you know, when you say that you need an HIV AIDS specialist pediatrician and you can pay them three or four times the salary they would make being a pediatric doctor for, you know, the central hospital in a country, then of course they're going to take that job. And then they're going to have very few patients. They're going to be able to pay the school fees for their own kids who are in school. And meanwhile, pediatric care at the central hospital in that country is going to be poor, right? So the distortions have real effects on people's real lives, even if in some cases they sometimes create opportunities for us to think about the broader umbrella under which these exceptional policy areas matter. So with, you know, food security, right? Don't just come in after a famine and distribute a bunch of food, you know, but create things like the early warning system and imagine things like, you know, cash transfers instead of food distribution so that you're propping up the local economy. You know, I think that there are people who are thinking of ways where it's not just a Band-Aid for a particular silo, but how can initiatives that are meant to target a particular crisis, how can they have a more broadly beneficial impact than just specifically on the issue we care about?
I'm glad you mentioned Partners in Health, because I've had numerous conversations with Paul Farmer on this matter. He actually made me feel very good about my initiative to promote long-term training to Malawian civil servants, because, you know, he's been highlighting in his own work that it really isn't about the sensational events as much as also the process. And I think that is an important part, you know, understanding, being there for a while, local knowledge, training local health workers to address these emergencies, or perhaps even prevent them in the first place. So I've been really inspired by Paul's work, and I hope to have him on the podcast shortly. My question, before we get into much more, you know, the national level focus, Kim, how do you think the international response to AIDS on the African continent is framed these days? Because in your book, of course, you do the literature review, and I just wondered if you have an update on that, because you very nicely, you know, you provide that overview that framing AIDS is, it can be a public health problem, it could be a developmental crisis kind of a way of looking at it, it could be a humanitarian issue. Some would even say it's a threat to U.S. security. Is that still the case? Have you seen a shift in the way in which the problem is framed these days?
Yeah, I do think that you know, there's not as much of the talk about HIV/AIDS as a security issue. I think that you know, those, anytime there's a new pandemic or new epidemic, you know, the first thing people do is get afraid. and so, you know, how do we secure our country from getting this debilitating disease? As of course we can see in this, in the current pandemic, right, is that, you know, people want to close borders and try to keep themselves safe. And so pandemics or, you know, infectious diseases are initially seen as security threats. Or if, you know, disease affects in particular military populations, right, soldiers and sailors, then of course, you know, people want to talk about it as a security issue. And then I think it became a humanitarian issue, right? So the next phase was, you know, seeing people thin and dying of AIDS, seeing children left behind as orphans because their parents had died. And so then it was this humanitarian emergency, right? And so it was framed that way, you know, and at the same time, you saw it also as a social justice issue. You know, why is it that rich people in the West can have access to care, but people in poor African countries cannot, right? And especially if we think about, you know, who are the populations that, where, for example, drug trials were happening, and yet these are the same populations in which access to those drugs is not widely available. So you know, security, then humanitarianism, and then you could see it, you know, also as a healthcare issue, right? And people were saying, you know, we need to strengthen health systems, right? And that if we strengthen health systems, then it's going to improve access to care and potential increased prevention of transmission if we strengthen health systems and provide HIV care in these strengthened health systems. And I think at the same time as we saw that, there was a focus on HIV/AIDS as a development issue, that if we don't tackle HIV/AIDS, that it's going to have severe consequences for development, because of course it was affecting people in the most productive years of their life. And if that happened at a broad scale in a society, then that society was going to lose a whole cohort of productive people. And what were the development losses from that? I think now, I don't want to say there's a postmortem on AIDS, but I do think that, you know, we've been living a long time. There's still no cure. There's no vaccine. And yet there is treatment that can lengthen people's lives. People who have HIV can have greater access to treatment. It's not universal, of course, but they have greater access to treatment, and we're seeing people live longer lives and you know, contribute to the economies and societies in which they live. And so I'm not sure that there is an overarching umbrella under which, you know, people who are studying HIV/AIDS are thinking about it. You know, I think people are trying to decide, you know, is this, I mean, HIV, you know, the human immunodeficiency virus is a virus. It is an infectious disease, right? But because there are drugs available to manage the illnesses associated with HIV/AIDS, you might also think of it as a chronic condition, right? So even among health researchers, you know, we know it's an infectious disease, but because there's also treatment, it's like, well, do we think of it, you know, do we think of the interventions and initiatives to combat HIV, do we think of them as, you know, immediate infectious disease control, or do we think of it as chronic disease management or some combination of the two? And I think, you know, we're in this, I don't know, I don't want to call it a purgatory, but we're in this kind of phase where it's unclear what to do, except maintain, you know, low transmission and care for the people, you know, continue treatment and care for the people who are already infected. And so I feel like right now we're in a maintenance phase. And what does that mean? And in the current donor climate, where there's not as much money to go around and drugs remain expensive, you know, just the maintenance of the current initiatives against HIV/AIDS is quite expensive and quite hard to manage. And I don't know what that means. I think that there's a lot of uncertainty among people who are working on and in HIV/AIDS initiatives to know how to make sense of what's happening right now.
From the global to national and local levels, Kim, one of the many things I liked about your book is how you very, very nicely make the argument that even before response, this international focus on HIV/AIDS became a global priority, there were actually very effective, or at least there was local community response. There was care. There were various organizations that were involved. There was actually local knowledge and responses to the problem. So my question is, if you could firstly help us better understand how these local responses worked, what characterized these responses? Were they effective? Were there certain aspects that were abandoned that we should actually be looking into? If you can just take us through that, how was the situation before this global response descended on many of these countries?
I think a lot of the local responses, you know, this was early in the pandemic, and so there wasn't much in the way of palliative care or treatment. So, or I should say, there wasn't much in the way of pharmaceutical palliative care and treatment, and so you saw a lot more care taken by relatives and communities of people who became ill. You saw, you know, warnings made by local leaders about what to avoid and how to keep yourself healthy. And, you know, I don't want to romanticize that period because, of course, many people died and especially when they were in poor settings, you know, many people, you know, for example, who may have gotten infected when they were minors in South Africa, you know, living a pretty good life and sending money back home to Malawi, and then they would get sick and have to return to their home village and, you know, not living as comfortable a life in terms of like creature comforts, but then also getting very ill and not having good access to healthcare. But having relatives and loved ones care for you in your last days, that's a pretty dignified way to go, right? Is to be surrounded by the people you love and having them take care of you, even if, you know, you are getting very ill. I, unfortunately, you know, one of the reasons why I don't want to romanticize that period is that the people who were doing that care work tended to be women, right? There's a strongly gendered component, and you know, we're seeing that in the current pandemic as well. You know, who is caring for those who get sick? You know, not just in healthcare institutions, but in homes. You know, who's bearing the burdens of that care work and not, you know, not having any kind of economic proof of that labor. And I do think, however, that some of the more community-based initiatives, you know, if we take it out of the household and look at more of the community-based initiatives, you know, I think that there were locally appropriate ways of talking about the disease. And I think that, you know, once you start bringing in messaging and language that was, you know, designed in the West, things got more confusing, and not everything translates well. But it suited our kind of Western notions of what is appropriate, what is good public health. You know, I mean, what do we even know about what good public health is? You know, we just know what good Western public health is. You know, public health and messaging around public health is really context specific, but unfortunately, public health has its own hierarchies of, you know, this is the right way to encourage people to adopt healthy behaviors. And it's like, there is no right way. You know, there are many ways in which we can communicate how people should keep themselves healthy and safe. And a way that works in New York City is not going to be the same as in Merced, California, you know, the county where I'm from. You know, so we have to recognize that, you know, there's many ways to craft messages around public health. And I, you know, the opening vignette in my book shows my own limited imagination of how we should be talking about ways to promote health. And there was this, you know, this mzee, this elder in Tanzania who was like, oh, well, just give us a list of everyone who's infected. And, you know, we'll put it with a trusted person in the village and everyone will know not to sleep with that person. And I was just like, oh my gosh, it's like they're going to have the scarlet letter. No, we can't do that. You know, that goes against all Western ideas of confidentiality with HIV testing. But he had a point. You know, if we would have done it his way, there probably would have been fewer people to get infected. So much as I don't like it because it's not the way I think about HIV/AIDS, I don't live in Arumeru District, Tanzania, you know. I don't think I should be the one telling this, you know, elder in the village that he's wrong.
You also have another example. Well, you have many examples in the book, but another one that I remember is one from, was it Mozambique, where there was this, you refer to this a media campaign to promote condom usage by making people pay for it because it was considered to be an effective way to actually promote ownership and that people would perhaps be more inclined to buy a condom or pay for it and in order to use it than if they got it for free. Is that a similar example in this context?
I love that example because it gives me an opportunity to dunk on economists during our little chat here. So yeah, right. There's this idea, right, among many, if not most, economists that you don't value something unless you pay for it. And so let's not give out condoms to people. Let's charge a small fee. It doesn't even have to cover the cost of the condom. It's not about recouping costs. It's about implanting in the mind of these Mozambicans that condoms are valuable and if they pay for it, they'll imagine them as valuable and they'll be more likely to use them. And it was just, you know, garbage thinking, you know, but not surprising from a group of people who, you know, their own academic literature is largely today, you know, this very kind of neoliberal capitalist way of thinking of things is, oh, if people don't pay for something, they don't value it. It's like, you know, I didn't pay for my mother. I value her very much. You know, I think that, you know, there are things and people and ideas that we can value even if we don't pay for them. And you know, condoms are fraught in so many ways on the continent and beyond, that I don't think that people have really thought through, you know, what does it mean to encourage condom use? And what are the consequences of that? And, you know, one of the great things about my having worked in Malawi is I got to work with a lot of people who focused on what a condom meant. Agnes Chimbiri, who is a scholar and now a development practitioner, who was at the time at the College of Medicine in Malawi, wrote a paper called "The Condom is an Intruder in Marriage." And it's this brilliant piece of work that basically shows us that this idea, you know, think of HIV infections in Malawi and elsewhere. You know, the infectious rate of HIV is sufficiently low that it's often, the transmission is often between, or I should say often within long-term partnerships, right? People who regularly have sex with each other, right? And so the target population then you might imagine are discordant couples, right? Couples where one person is HIV positive and the other person is HIV negative. And how do you introduce, you know, how do you tell married people to use condoms, right? A condom is an intruder in marriage, right? It's this idea that if you're telling me that we're going to use condoms in our marriage, you're telling me that there's a reason we shouldn't trust each other. And what is a marriage if not a relationship built on trust? And so, you know, Agnes Chimbiri's work and the work of many others, I think, highlights how important it is for us to better understand condoms in a local context. I don't even think you have to go that far. Like, just think of condoms in your own life. You know, do you want to use a condom in marriage? You know, like, people don't necessarily have sex for the opportunity to use a condom, right? I mean, it's kind of the other way around. And so if you actually think through what this would mean in practice, I think you avoid some of the pitfalls of development, right? And whether it's condoms or something else, right? Like used clothing, you know, do you think that's what's going to take someone out of poverty? You know, you sending your old shirts to Goodwill, you know, that's not how we should think about development or inequality or poverty. We have to imagine the thing that we're doing or the thing that we are sharing. Is that thing actually useful? Would we actually use it? Is the way it's being given or shared, is that dignified and thoughtful about how the person is going to use it?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned used clothing, because I recently co-authored a piece for The Conversation with a colleague, and I've never received so much attention. It went almost viral, but I was criticized by those who thought it was a matter of dignity not to wear it. And there were others who said, of course, you know, this is sustainable and we should promote it. So it is such a fascinating discourse, used clothing. I want to move on to the kind of media, scholarly, policy-related attention on the political response to AIDS on the African continent. And you write about this, of course, in the book, but also in many other works. There's been this kind of focus on leaders who don't take it seriously, who never did when this problem was starting, like Zaire's Mobutu or you know, the much maligned example of South Africa's Thabo Mbeki, unlike many other leaders, or certain other leaders like Zambia's Kenneth Kaunda and Museveni of Uganda. And in one of the many courses that I teach, I actually have this massive open online course with Stanford called What Works. We have actually used the Museveni-Uganda example as a success story. He was there. He was there. You know, he hit the ground running and he recognized the problem and for all kinds of other reasons. And you cite the work of Parkhurst and others who've highlighted that kind of success, how he actually got funding in innovative ways from the World Bank rather than the WHO. You know, he played donors against each other. So there have been lots of analyses saying that Museveni's success story should have been replicated elsewhere. And yet, you know, many others say, well, Uganda was a success for a while, and then it went downhill. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. I think it depends on when you look at it. And I think in the same way, I think that it's fair to say that Museveni early on should be looked at as a success, because his early response to HIV/AIDS was indeed what his country needed. His current response to HIV/AIDS and various other issues facing Ugandans is not great. And so I would characterize his current response as not a success, right? So I this is the problem when someone rules for so long. You know, you can't have one narrative about your rule, right? When you rule for that long, there's going to be times when you were great and times when you weren't. And I think that, you know, it's, as a political scientist, it was really hard for me to get at this question about, you know, leaders and their role in epidemics. I found it so unsatisfying to say Museveni was good and Thabo Mbeki was bad. It's like, okay, well then if Museveni were to be ousted in a coup, would things change? Right. So I don't know. I mean, maybe because I was trained by a bunch of institutionalists, you know, I wondered what was it about the political institutional context that made Museveni respond in the way that he did? What were the incentives around him to respond in the way that he did? And if we look at that, you know, it makes sense that he had, quote, a successful response early on and, quote, a dismal response currently. And that's because early on, you know, who was affected by HIV/AIDS? Largely his soldiers. This is a guy who came to office, you know, through a coup, you know, or let's say a revolutionary movement, however you want to characterize his coming to power. And how has he maintained power? You know, and HIV/AIDS today, is it threatening his population of security forces? Probably not. And so maybe he doesn't have to care about it as much. And so maybe, you know, I think if we think of it that way, it's helpful to us, not just for understanding the variation in his own response to HIV/AIDS, but leaders more broadly. And I have other work on this, not in the book, called Executive Time Horizons in Response to AIDS in Africa, where it's an article that I published in Comparative Political Studies. And it looks at, you know, it looks at not the leaders as people, but the leaders as, you know, right again, not Museveni as a good guy and Thabo Mbeki as a bad guy, but leaders as people who are seeing the lay of the land and making decisions according to that. You know, so in the case of South Africa, for example, there are regular elections, and something like HIV/AIDS, which takes 8 to 12 years to manifest in someone without access to drugs, you know, and you have an election in 5 years, you might not prioritize it even as many people are getting infected and dying. But someone like a Robert Mugabe, who thinks he's going to rule from the grave and rule forever, you know, 8 to 12 years is not a long time. You know, that's on your horizon. So you are actually going to do something about HIV/AIDS. And I think we can take some of those lessons and think about the current pandemic, right? I don't want to say, you know, the US has had a poor response to COVID-19 because of Donald Trump, right? The way I want to think about it is the U.S. has had a poor response to COVID-19 because of the political context in which a leader like Trump doesn't have to do anything meaningful in response to the pandemic, and people can die and there are not political consequences for him.
Kim, one of the benefits of reading a book and enjoying it as much as I did reading yours is that I have too many questions and we don't really have that much time left. So I want to move on to a final set of issues and then, you know, somewhat moving back to Malawi. And, you know, there has been, not just in a Malawian context, but also in many other situations, this discourse on the role of traditional authorities, the role of village chiefs and the kind of chiefs as despots narrative versus the chiefs as the bearers, the promoters of local trust and legitimacy. What are your thoughts on traditional authority as an institution? Because you devote quite a lot of space in the book to the Malawian headman, to a better understanding the role of chiefs. How do you see that institution playing out in the near future?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of what I've written and done in my work on chiefs is quite controversial, especially among my Malawian scholarly friends, because many of them are of the opinion of, you know, these chiefs are unqualified and, what do they know? And they're holding us back from true development and democracy. And, you know, I think for some chiefs that might be true, but I think there are others where, you know, they're for better or worse, they're the ones that people trust. And some of them have used that trust capital in ways that are really useful for not just themselves, but for their communities, right? So we think, for example, of Kachinda Moto in Dedza, right? Of the Ngoni in Malawi. You know, she has done so much to promote gender empowerment in Malawi. And it's because of her position. Now, if she were a terrible person or, you know, ruled with an iron fist, you know, maybe she would have an equivalent negative effect on the communities over which, you know, she has jurisdiction. But in my own encounters with village headmen, they govern in ways that recognizes the limits of their power. So as I document in the book, if you're a bad headman, the people kick you out. You know, everyone says, oh, well, a village headman appointment is for life. Technically, yes, that's true. But if you're really bad at it, the villagers boot you and they pick someone else to take your place. And sure, like they might have to follow a certain hereditary line, but there are procedures for this. And there's also social shaming. And there's, you know, there are social mechanisms for dealing with a bad village headman. And I guess I have a lot more faith, I think, in villagers standing up to bad headmen because I've seen it. You know, I've literally been in a part of Malawi, in Mchinji, Malawi, which is on the west side of Malawi on the border with Zambia in the central region, where a group of women, you know, there was this traditional authority, a TA, who was a young guy. He was appointed, you know, probably much earlier than he was ready for the job. And he was a drunkard. I mean, he literally would find him in Mchinji Boma, drunk, walking around, you know, just a useless guy. And anytime there was some sort of development activity for which he could earn a per diem for, quote, representing his traditional authority, he was there, nine sharp, you know. But if it was something like a hearing in his court about, you know, grievances that, you know, people in his traditional authority had, he was always late or didn't show up or would show up drunk, you know, and people realized this. And, you know, that guy, he was so unpopular. I mean, he would walk down the street in the Boma and people would hiss at him. I mean, and he didn't last long. He didn't continue to be the TA. He was replaced. You know, so technically he had a life appointment, but he didn't serve for life because he was bad. And so I think that much as, you know, there's this long scholarship of chiefs and headmen as decentralized despots, I didn't see that in Malawi. I don't want to speak about village headmen or chieftaincy in other countries that I know less well. But from the explorations that I have in the book about chieftaincy in Lesotho, Botswana, and Zambia, you see some similarities there. And I just think that we need to be careful and mindful in the way we talk about chieftaincy and the way we talk about headmen, because to say that they're despots suggests that the people they govern or the people they collectively represent don't have any agency in keeping them in check. And I don't think that that's always true.
Congratulations on a fantastic book, Kim. I really enjoyed this conversation with you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show, Dan.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is Global Dev Pod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.